This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on September 24th, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The second item on our agenda involves an advisory opinion in 2007-13 for the United American Nurses. Mr. Vice Chairman, we have a late submitted document there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider agenda document 0760.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion is again passed by a vote of 5-0. We have on this matter from the General Counsel's Office Cheryl Hemsley and Amy Rothstein. Ms. Hemsley, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, good morning. The United American Nurses AFL-CIO requested the advisory opinion before you in agenda document 07-60. The request asks whether under the Act and Commission regulations, an SSF that the union wishes to establish would be affiliated with the SSF of the American Nurses Association, the organization that originally established the union. The two organizations have been working and will continue to work until at least July 1st, 2008 under an autonomy and affiliation agreement. The draft first determines that the two organizations are not per se affiliated and then goes on to use the affiliation factors at 100.5G and 110.3 to analyze the overall relationship between the two organizations. Based on all the facts and circumstances, the draft concludes that the union and the association are not affiliated, and thus any SSF established by the union would not be affiliated with the association's SSF. We received one timely and one late submitted comment on the draft, and Mr. Chairman, I have two small corrections I'd like to make, if I may.
Please.
On page 7, line 21,
yes.
We would like to replace the word represents with has and insert the word member between 97,000 and RNs.
Okay.
And thank the commission. I'd be pleased to answer questions. Okay.
Very good. Any discussion on the document before us? Seeing none, any motions on the document before us? Mr. Vice Chairman.
I will make a motion. I just wanted to clarify one or discuss one point here because it was relevant to some difficulties that we had had, not really difficulties because we got through it pretty easily with the, I believe it may have been the last AO we had up, which was corporations that were disaffiliating, separating. And there was a significant concern on the part of the staff about the issue of how much shareholder overlap was acceptable, as it were, and under what circumstances and so on like that. And we were able to address that, I think, in a useful way. But I just wanted to note here we have another advisory opinion request and in which there appears to be very substantial membership overlap. And what we're looking at, rather than the individual members, are the different purposes and operations and structure and governance of the organization. And I think that's appropriate, but I just wanted to note that I think we ought to take some cognizance of the fact that the overlap in membership by itself is not a particularly significant factor, and consequently not get too stuck on that, whether it comes up in a union or voluntary association context, as is here, or a corporate context where it may arise the next time.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to make sure there was a we're ready for a motion, or do we have some other correction?
For those of you who've never lived through it, the struggle over the distinction between union members and bargaining unit members is bedeviling in many, many different contexts, and it is presented itself here as well. Apparently the original draft had represented there were 97,000 bargaining unit members, whereas actually those are actual members, and there's slightly more people in the bargaining unit, and there was some effort to try and discern exactly how many more people there were who are not actual members, and rather than sort of coming up with that exact number, the General Counsel's office has proposed simply a rephrasing of that to reflect that these are the actual members, and so I was just being asked whether this was completely or sufficient, and so currently,
could I raise the question as to whether our determination about that would have any effect on either?
None whatsoever. Yeah, no. This is just the trying to avoid the awkwardness of not actually being factually accurate in our documents, and that's something we strive to achieve. It doesn't have any effect whatsoever on the outcome or the issues before us. Actually, this would be somewhat, in the parlance of labor relations, this would be somewhat more accurate if it said currently, through its 27 subordinate state affiliates, the union has approximately 97,000 member RNs in collective bargaining units. Would, I think, be a somewhat more accurate phrasing of this. We also could say the union represents approximately 47,000 member RNs, which would avoid.
Would it help if we just said they had a bunch of members?
Yeah, well, the number here is accurate. It's just how we say it. I guess to bring this more in the way these things tend to be phrased in labor relations. I guess my suggestion to this question of the staff is if we left the word represents rather than has. I mean, they are actually representing these 97,000 members. Otherwise, the collective bargaining needs, a noun.
For the record, the council is nodding affirmatively.
Not exactly, Mr. Vice Chairman. I believe my understanding is that the union represents some nurses that are not actually part of that 97,000 RN
right.
figure there. So
right.
there are more people represented for collective bargaining
okay.
purposes than just the 97,000.
I think the very often we imply the concept of good enough, and I think the staff's recommendation will serve under that standard. So I think a motion would be appropriate at this time.
Chairman, I move approval of draft advisory opinion 2007-13 as set forth in agenda document 0760 with the amendment on page 7 as previously discussed.
Okay, very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Council, thank you very much. The next item on our agenda involves draft advisory opinion 2007-14. We have two alternative drafts, and this has been presented by the Associated Building Contractors, the National Federation of Independent Businessmen, and the National Restaurant Association. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider the alternative draft set forth in agenda document 0761.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We have on this matter from our General Counsel's office, S.S. Farah, Stacey Shin, and Amy Rothstein. Counsel, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. The two draft alternative advisory opinions before you respond to requests from three trade associations, Associated Builders and Contractors, the National Federation of Independent Business, and the National Restaurant Association. The requesters plan to jointly sponsor a series of live telephone conferences featuring presidential candidates, which will be open to the requesters' restricted classes. The requesters ask whether they may jointly sponsor the telephone conferences in this manner. Draft A concludes that the requesters may not jointly sponsor the telephone conferences because the conferences do not fall within the scope of the exemptions from the definitions of contribution and expenditure for corporate-sponsored candidate appearances before the restricted class. Draft B concludes the requesters may sponsor the telephone conferences as permissible corporate-sponsored candidate appearances before the restricted class, provided that they split the costs of the conferences on a pro rata basis determined by the restricted class participation or other reasonable method, to ensure that each trade association does not subsidize the cost of candidate appearances to the restricted class other than its own. This office asks that a technical amendment be made to any draft the Commission adopts to add Carol A. Laham's name to the address line and to the salutation. We received one comment on the draft, which is from the requesters, and I'll be happy to address any questions you may have. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Certainly we will be more than delighted to give Carol her due on this one. She is a learned and esteemed counsel, and her presence before us is always appreciated. Discussion. Anyone? I'll chime in if no one else will, but I guess I will lead. I think that this was a close question. I mean, traditionally, my sense is that this agency has perceived communications to the restricted class to be limited to that, and organizations cannot cross restricted classes to make those kinds of communications. This presented a somewhat interesting circumstance in which a number of these organizations, which are trade associations, but I think are also membership organizations people voluntarily choose to join. And they want to jointly sponsor a conference call with candidates for the Office of the President of the United States to discuss issues of interest to their members. This is a practice, that these meetings with candidates is a practice that is growing in politics right now. There are any number of these sponsored forums or events involving presidential candidates. And there is, quite frankly, I think, a great deal of competition among groups to have candidates speak to their members about the issues that concern them. And my sense is, anecdotal though it is, that the campaigns are actually quite pressed by these kinds of requests and competing needs for dates and times. And I think quite realistically, these groups believe that if they pool together their respective memberships, they're more likely to get candidates to actually appear and present their views to their members, and are willing to jointly split the cost. And it is very important to me that it would present no cross-subsidization of the costs of the event. But they're willing to try and jointly split the costs of this event between them relative to their membership. And for all of those reasons, I think this seems like a reasonable place to view our rules with some flexibility and I would vote to permit this kind of activity to occur. I think that the need or value of citizens and voters coming together to try and advance their interests and to communicate with candidates is enormously valuable, and I think it is often a missing piece in our politics and cuts against the sense of isolation and separateness that voters often have with the candidates and the politics of our moment. And so while I am sure that these groups and I might differ on the substance of some of the things they are advancing, I think the means and methods by which they're going about it are probably on balance more helpful than not to our politics. And so my thinking on this would be to support draft B, which would permit this kind of activity. So that's my two cents. Others? Vice Chairman Mason.
Well, I concur with the chairman. Be happy to make a motion, though. Other colleagues want to speak, I'd be
okay.
Happy to
see what others have to say. Commissioner Walther.
I'm going to support the other draft, but I understand where the consensus here is on this particular matter. I'm particularly concerned with the barrier that has always existed between, you know, the class that's entitled to participate and the class that's not. And here we find ourselves agreeing on a kind of the beginning of a merger toward those kinds of communication, overlapping with people who are not directly involved in particular corporations. And I'm concerned about that extra step that takes place. And while here we're talking about telephone conferences, I'm not sure the next step would be personal appearances or other kinds of activity that get people more directly involved. I noticed that, you know, in a previous here we're talking about not just communication, but also solicitation for contributions and volunteers. And I think at this point, it just is a step beyond where I'm willing to go, so I'm supporting the other draft of the OGCs.
Okay, very good. Other comments? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I support draft B also, but I wanted to answer the concern that Commissioner Walther just expressed, which I don't think is really a concern. I mean, I understand the concern, but I don't think this AO, the way it's written, should raise that concern for a couple of reasons. First of all, this AO is based on a very specific set of facts, and if the facts were different, then we all might conclude they couldn't do this. And this is written very carefully. I don't think it in any way changes our precedent or our prior rules about this. And I mean, you mentioned solicitation, but if as the requester made very clear, there isn't going to be any endorsements, any express advocacy statements, or any solicitations in this. You know, none of the companies or trade associations that are doing this are going to do that. And so none of the members of the restricted class of one association is going to hear some kind of communication from one of the other trade associations that they normally shouldn't hear. So, I mean, that really is not a problem here. And, you know, the three restricted classes are all going to hear exactly the same message from the presidential candidate. And I don't see any difference between doing this way than if you did this physically. You know, if you had three different trade associations and they all rented three ballrooms right next to each other, and they were all going to listen to the same candidate, and the candidate was going to go to the first ballroom at 8 o'clock, the second ballroom at 9, the third ballroom at 10, and give the exact same message in each one. You know, each ballroom has been paid for separately by each of the trade associations. You know, taking down the walls between the three ballrooms and letting the candidate give his message or her message once instead of having to repeat it three times, I just don't see that as being a problem. And so I think because of this is very limited to a very specific set of facts, that I don't think we're going to go in the direction that you fear because of the restrictions that we've put in here and the specific things the requesters have said are not going to occur at this point. Which I think would change and could possibly change the result and what we would say about it.
Very good. Thank you. Commissioner Weintraub.
It's all up to me. I also think this is a very close question, and I went back and forth in my own mind a couple of times as I was considering this, and might have voted now I have to make sure I'm describing these. I have the same notes. A is no and B is yes. I might have been inclined to vote for the A draft. However, if I do that, it's pretty clear to me we're not going to have four votes for anything. And I do think that we have an obligation to try and answer people's questions when they ask them. And in a close case where I'm somewhat of two minds, I'm willing to vote with the majority in order to provide an answer to the requester rather than have us, you know, in this indecisive posture of having a 3-2 vote. And then I suppose that's effectively a no for the requester, but it's not a clear statement for the commission. And as I said, if on a close case, I have in the past been willing to do that in order to provide some definitive advice. So that's what I'm going to do.
Okay. Very good. Vice Chairman Mason.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of draft B of Advisory Opinion 2007-14 with the amendment to add Carol Laham in the address and citation lines.
Thank you for remembering the amendment there. Any discussion?
Oh, in that case, no.
We'll strike that remark from the record. The any discussion on the Vice Chairman's motion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Nay.
Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion, it has been adopted by a vote of 4-1 with Commissioner Walther dissenting. Thank you very much, Council. The The next item on our agenda involves draft advisory opinion 2007-15 involving GMAC LLC. We again have a late submitted document, which includes two alternative drafts. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider the alternative drafts of advisory opinion 2007-15 as set forth in agenda document 0762.
The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman continues on a roll today with a vote of 5-0 in favor of his motion. We have Richard Yule and Amy Rothstein from the General Counsel's Office. Mr. Yule, at your convenience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are two alternative drafts before you in Agenda Document 07-62. These drafts respond to a request for an advisory opinion from GMAC LLC, a financial services company. The request asks whether GMAC may pay the establishment and administrative costs of a new separate segregated fund that would be connected to a corporate subsidiary of GMAC, which is GMAC Insurance Holdings Incorporated. In addition, the request asks whether the SSF may be named GMAC LLC PAC and use GMAC PAC as an abbreviation. Draft A concludes that GMAC may not pay the establishment or administrative costs for the SSF because it is not entirely owned by corporations. Draft B reaches the opposite conclusion, focusing on the affiliation between GMAC and its corporate subsidiary and noting that a majority, if not all, of GMAC's owners are corporations. The drafts also reach opposite conclusions as to the proposed name of the PAC, with Draft A prohibiting the requested name and abbreviation, and Draft B allowing both. The Commission's received one comment on the drafts from the requester, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Comments? Suggestions? Comments? No? Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the draft that would allow the LLC to pay the expenses of the PAC here. And I'm told that's B.
Yeah, B permits prohibits it. It's a flip from the last one.
And I just wanted to note some concerns I have about how we approach the chain of reasoning that we have in really in either draft, and it goes a little bit to the comment and the question about the ownership significance. And two points by way of background. The requester's attorneys will understand that it makes it more difficult for us when we don't have a full set of facts, and I assume their clients have interests other than FICA that caused them not to want to disclose their ownership structure, and so I understand that, but that is just an element that's out there that makes resolving this a little bit harder. The second problem I had in thinking about the best way to approach this was in thinking about the outcome, because the one thing that I think has been consistent in the advisory opinions and in the revisions that we did to the rules on LLCs was an effort to try to fix it so that every entity had some place that they could fit within the election law to make contributions one way or the other, either in the corporate SSF structure or in the partnership structure, as complicated as that is. And as I recall the LLC regs, we were really thinking about a pretty simple model where the LLCs that we were at least most conscious of really did bear kinship to partnerships and in partnerships in the sense of a law firm or accounting firm where it's a single entity involved. And of course, very soon after that, we started getting advisory opinions with these very complex ownership structures. And one of the concerns I've got in a situation such as this one is whether if we deny them the ability to operate in effect as a corporation with their affiliates, whether it would be practically possible for the LLC to make any contributions. Because under the attribution rules, the contributions could be made, but then they would have to be attributed to a non-corporate owner. We're aware of a number of corporate owners. There's this other owner out there that I'll just assume is not corporate, And the contributions would have to be attributed to that LLC, and yet I assume that LLC would have to further attribute its corporations. And given the nature of that ownership LLC, I'm willing to bet that there are complex ownership structures behind that, and that there are more LLCs and, you know, possibly corporations and PCs and whoever knows who knows what kind of beasts behind behind Cerberus. And so,
thank you.
That wasn't an accident.
Three-headed ones, no doubt.
Well, probably more. And so, one of the things that that inclines me to interpret our rules in a way to allow GMAC to go ahead and operate with a PAC structure is the fact that the alternative may be effectually a prohibition on their making a contribution, because their ability to go through, even if ultimately some number of non-corporate owners existed, their ability to properly attribute through a complex chain of ownership might make it effectively impossible for them to do that. So that's just sort of a background that I looked at this one and got my head scratching. The other concern that I've got is, as I see, one of the first advisory opinions in this chain, 1987-34, which Mr. Barron in his comment drew our attention to, we had a partnership that was the owner of a corporation, and we did an affiliation analysis and said, by virtue of the affiliation, let's see if I can find the language. The foregoing conclusion as to the affiliate status of Sprint JV in relation to Telenet also means that either Telenet or Sprint JV may establish and finance a payroll deduction plan, so on. And then what we apparently had following that was a series of advisory opinions where the corporate ownership structure was reversed, and the corporation, in essence, sat on top of the non-corporate entity. And, of course, in addition, in Telenet, we had the two corporate owners ultimately behind that partnership. I guess my concern about the way we read those advisory opinions is I don't want to take a series of submissions where the factual predicates that were laid out in a series of advisory opinions then harden into the rule. And that's my concern about frankly, the issue that Mr. Barron has brought to our attention. I haven't had the opportunity to give it as much thought as I normally would, but I am concerned about that, and I'm not readily willing to sort of accept that, gosh, we've got to have an ultimate corporate owner, and rather the rule shouldn't be affiliation is enough, whether the partnership is on top of the corporation or the corporation on top of the partnership. I've thoroughly confused my guys.
No, not at, well. It is a confusing matter, and I think we've all spent a lot of time thinking about this, in part because it involves partnerships and corporations and limited liability corporate structures, and those are not the kinds of things that drew any of us to this job. And in part, I took some comfort in part because it struck me as I was going through this that this was submitted to us by Mr. Barron, who is a very distinguished member of the bar before us, and it's appropriate that that he brings hard questions to us. The easy questions I'm sure he answers easily, and the moderately hard ones he researches and thinks about and comes up with a reasonable answer, and it's consequently the most difficult ones that he sends to us, and I didn't feel quite so bad as struggling my way through this. For me, I come out in a different place from the vice chairman on this, and in part arising from some of the same concerns. We do have I guess for me in the where I began my thinking about this is that we have for a long time had a general sense or appreciation of the law, which was that partnerships could not have PACs. that they were legally permitted to make contributions themselves, and that the PACs by statute and most appropriately belonged to entities which by themselves could not make contributions, such as corporations or labor unions. And the law provided them with the opportunity, the statute provides them with the opportunity to create a PAC as an alternative structure. And that consequently, because partnerships can give directly, they do not need that as well. And here we have a situation in which there is a corporate structure, which I guess is the life insurance entity, as well as which is owned by a partnership. And as the vice chairman noted, our staff, it is not entirely clear who owns or controls the partnership. Certainly, we have an understanding of partial ownership, but not a complete one. And this is important because we have created an exception to the restriction on partnerships having PACs in those instances in which the partnership is entirely made up of corporations. And in those circumstances, because the contributions of the partnership cannot be attributed to any entity which legally could make the contribution, and consequently the partnership cannot make contributions directly, we have allowed those kinds of partnerships to have PACs. And that all makes some sense for me. The problem with the record we have before us now is that we don't entirely understand the ownership structure of this partnership, and I take from that a presumption that it is not entirely owned at the end by corporations, and that there is somewhere in that ownership structure an entity, be they individuals or otherwise, that could make contributions. And so I take from this a somewhat greater departure from our prior precedent, or to the degree that people were to derive an understanding of the law from this advisory opinion, that entities that were not GMAC were to derive an understanding of the law from this opinion, they would perceive a shift in our rules that I think is unwarranted here. It strikes me that in the alternative, either the corporate structure could establish and pay itself for the costs of administering this PAC and make contributions directly from itself, or in the alternative, as near as the record reflects, the partnership could make contributions as well. It may be, as the vice chairman says, that there, were one to trace the chain all the way up, that there is complete corporate ownership, but for reasons unrelated to FICA, that cannot be conveyed to us. But for the decision that lies before me, I must go forward with the assumption that, in fact, there is not complete corporate ownership, and there are entities up the ownership chain at GMAC that could make contributions on their own, or for whom contributions could be attributed. And so, possibly because of the record, possibly because I perceive this as a fundamental shift in the general restrictions on partnerships having PACs, I am going to vote for staff draft A in this case, or draft A, I'm sorry, which would not permit the parent partnership to pay the administrative costs of the PAC. Other comments or thoughts? Both the vice chairman and I have really gone on at some length about this. Sorry for that. Commissioner von Spakovsky, Walther, or Weintraub, any other comments on this? Commissioner von Spakovsky.
Well, I guess I'm this was a complex corporate structure here, but I guess the issue didn't seem that complex to me, because there are forms on file with the SEC that show that the ultimate parent of this organization, the majority, is owned by corporations. There's a form on file with the SEC that says that GMAC LLC is 49% owned by GM, which is a corporation, and 51% owned by FIM Holdings LLC, an investment consortium set up to acquire the 51% interest, and it's made up of another LLC, Cerebras, Citigroup Inc., Azora Bank Limited, and PNC Financial Services Group Inc. So basically, there are four entities in the ultimate, in that 51%, three of which are corporations. Now, I have a hard time believing that those three corporations together own less than 1%. And since GM owns 49%, it's pretty clear to me that you have a majority ownership with corporations. And that brings us within the Pharmavite AO that we've done before. You've got a parent company attempting to pay the SS costs of a wholly owned subsidiary, and I think we fit both within our affiliation factors and otherwise to allow them to do this.
Thank you. Other comments, thoughts, suggestions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am inclined to support, make sure I get this one right, draft A. I'm not really comfortable with the position we find ourselves in, saying, well, you know, we can infer from SEC documents it must be a majority. We don't know how big a majority is, but it's got to be more than 50%. I don't like issuing opinions that have language in them, like the sentence on draft B, page 4, while GMAC's ownership structure is not entirely apparent because the principles and tax status of Cerberus FIM Investors LLC are not disclosed, it's clear that at least a majority, if not all, I don't know that we have any reason to believe it's all, of GMAC's owners are corporations. I mean, it's not good enough for me. I need to know what we're talking about here, and the rule has never been, as long as a majority of the owners are corporations, that's good enough. That in and of itself, even if we had definitive evidence that showed us that it was 55% or 60% or 70% or whatever it is, we have not adopted that rationale in the past. So I am more comfortable with, and like the chairman, I have to keep checking to make sure that I'm looking at the right draft. I'm more comfortable with draft A.
Other comments, thoughts, suggestions? Commissioner Walther.
I would join the comments of the chairman and Commissioner Weintraub. I think that if we were to move in the direction of allowing an LLC to both make contributions and administer an LLC, we basically just be eviscerating the barrier that we've made before in terms of saying that, well, if you have a partnership that's wholly owned by a corporation, none can be done. Here we'll say it could be, and we just really have never made that leap, and I don't see a policy reason for it, a statutory reason for doing that, and especially in the absence of facts that I think should be made available to us in order for us to clarify any issue with respect to ownership as well. So I support the staff draft A as well.
Okay. Vice Chairman Mason.
Just wanted to clarify a thing or two. First, do we understand if we allowed the insurance subsidiary to establish a PAC, would GMAC, the LLC, treated as a partnership? Would employees of GMAC be part of the solicitable class for GMAC Insurance PAC?
Yes, I think the answer is yes. The test for whom can be solicited does depend, I believe, entirely on the affiliation as opposed to who can pay for the establishment or administrative costs. So I think the answer would be yes, they can. The SSF would be permitted to solicit the restricted class of GMAC LLC.
That's helpful to me, and I know we're drawing some pretty fine legal distinctions either way, and one of the concerns I had early on, and I suppose I still might have ultimately, is we're talking about the rules that we can derive here, and I think this situation is sort of sui generis. There isn't another organization out there like this one, or at least I strongly suspect there isn't another one out there like this one. But one of the concerns I had was I didn't want to adopt a rule that, in this case, from my view, for effectively convenience and ease of administration, we might allow this organization, though organized as an LLC, taxed as a partnership, to effectively run its subsidiaries PAC. I wouldn't want that analysis to be laid on top of a, say, far simpler, smaller LLC that wanted instead to be able to make contributions directly. And so I appreciate counsel's office and my colleagues struggling with this, and I really do think this is one of those situations where there isn't really a rule, if you will, that clearly governs this, and whatever we do, we should be kind of careful about not trying to impose a very general rule that will make it more rather than less difficult to administer this as to requests that come forward in the future. And that's one of the reasons I thought some flexibility was in order here, but I'm particularly concerned that whatever we do, we don't do something that has implications we're not even thinking about today, and then find ourselves or our successors perhaps feel themselves bound by some rule that we attempted to lay down, when in fact what we're trying to do is construe the existing rules and regulations as they affect this particular entity. This is one of the times when I'm sympathetic. I think Commissioner Weintraub brought it up previously, or maybe it was the chairman, that we could get the requester's counsel up here, because the thing I don't understand at this point is what difference it would make. In other words, I suppose there may be some psychological difference in terms of GMAC insurance PAC soliciting people who don't work for the insurance subsidiary. In other words, they can solicit these other employees, but maybe other employees say, well, I don't work for the insurance company, so why are you asking me? And I suppose that might have some difference. But if, in fact, the operational effect is that the insurance subsidiary has to pay the overhead, and who knows, maybe there's some insurance regulations out there in various states that affect this. I don't know. But assuming the insurance subsidiary can go ahead and pay to operate and administer the PAC, then it's one of those situations where it's a little bit like Commissioner Weintraub. It may be, but I don't know, better to give them a yes and tell them go ahead and do the insurance thing than it would be to lock up and say nothing.
Okay. Let me go back to the vice chairman's question, because I would have assumed the answer was different. Assuming that the insurance subsidiary, which is a corporation and is permitted by law to have a PAC, were to create a PAC, its solicitable class includes what pool of individuals? Certainly the restricted class of the insurance company itself is included. And I assume that the quote-unquote owners, which in most cases are the stockholders, right, are among the solicitable class as well. And what would you interpret that class to consist of? And are there others beyond the quote-unquote owners that would be solicitable?
Let me see if I can address this. I think the question that you're getting at, if I understand it, is how what is the relationship between GMAC LLC and its personnel and the subsidiary corporation that would allow the SSF that's connected to the subsidiary corporation to solicit GMAC personnel, the restricted class. The test there is affiliation. The key would be that GMAC LLC is affiliated with the corporate subsidiary, which is the Insurance Holdings Corporation, and our regulations permit the solicitation of the connected organization and the affiliate, the restricted class of the affiliate corporation. That's why I was answering the vice chairman's question in that way.
Okay. And there are a range of other sort of entities that are controlled by the LLC as well, other kinds of, I guess, LLCs and corporations that operate, for the want of a better term, on the organizational chart at the same level of the insurance company. Do those fall within the restricted class of the insurance company, I guess, under either of these drafts?
You're talking about the people, the ownership structure above GMAC?
No, the GMAC LLC, as I understand it, controls many different entities, one of which is the insurance company. Am I correct?
So you're talking about other subsidiaries of
correct.
GMAC LLC?
Yeah.
I think they're, I mean, the test I think would be of whether they are affiliated. I'm trying to think through the structure of whether the another subsidiary would be going up and down the chain to get to affiliation, up to GMAC and down to the subsidiary again. I think they may. I think the answer is yes.
That under both drafts, that all of the other subsidiaries fall within the restricted class?
If they're affiliated, then they would be permitted, the SSF would be permitted to solicit the restricted class of the connected organization and its affiliates. So if we're saying that they are affiliated, I think the answer would be yes.
Okay. Commissioner Weintraub.
Mr. Chairman, I'm growing increasingly uncomfortable with what we're doing here because this question was not, it may have been implicit in the request, but it was not specifically asked, and it was not specifically incorporated into the analysis. And we're trying to sort it out at the table, and our counsel says, well, I think that's right, and you may well be right, but I know I haven't had a chance to, you know, sort through this issue because it was not an issue to be decided. So I think that whatever we do here, we can't say we're going to vote for one draft or the other draft. Oh, but, you know, we think, you know, based on, it's not legal precedent of the commission, whatever exchange we have with counsel here at the table. And I know counsel is smart enough to have figured that out, but it's not something that anybody can rely on. And I don't think that we can establish that as a, you know, unless somebody's going to put it in a draft and it's going to get four votes. And I wouldn't be comfortable voting for anything that said that because, as I said, it hasn't really been presented to us before, you know, 5 minutes ago, and I haven't had a chance to think it through. This conversation is interesting but not binding.
No, I agree. And I think probably what I was going to suggest is that we take a 5-minute recess because I'd like to think through the implications of treating the questions related to the what constitutes the restricted class and how that relates to the allocation of administrative expenses. So, I'm sorry, Vice Chairman Mason.
Let me, if you wouldn't mind holding off for just a minute. I thought the answer was obvious from my experience, and I just asked it to sort of establish something that I thought was obvious in an effort to think through whether I needed to do what Commissioner Weintraub did on the last one, and that is to say, well, I didn't really like A, but, you know, if it gives them an answer and lets them operate. And I suspect that that counsel didn't ask this question because counsel thought the question was obvious, because I can assure my colleagues, and I don't mean, by the way, to press them, we have to vote on this today, that we have, in fact, looked at these situations where we had the subsidiary, the parent, wholly owned subsidiary, parent, and a different wholly owned subsidiary, and said, yes, all within this integrated corporate family you can solicit. And so, you know, I didn't think we were plowing new ground, which is why I, otherwise, if I had, I would have, you know, brought this up ahead of time. But that being the case, and we can take a recess and think about it, my reaction is that maybe we should step back. If we need to ask for an extension, ask for an extension, because if, as I say, the practical effect is that the insurance company has to put its name on the pack and pay the expenses, but the solicitable class sort of remains the same, then that makes a different choice for me, and it may make a different choice for my colleagues. And if we're just not sure, I think, you know, we owe it to ourselves to take the time to get comfortable with that answer.
Okay, very good. We will take a short 5-minute recess. Thank you. Okay, thank you. We are returning from a short recess and are returning to the matter at hand, which is the draft advisory opinion in 2007-15, or in fact, I guess there are two draft advisory opinions. I understand that our counsel has had a communication with the with the requester's counsel, one of the on an issue which I had asked our counsel to question them about, which is whether there were problems with our holding this matter over till our next meeting, which occurs on October 11th, and giving us some time to sort of parse through this, you know, in a more reflective or contemplative way than we may be capable of doing here at the table. And I would like to hear from our counsel on that. I believe the vice chairman has a comment he'd like to make as well. So we'll begin with counsel.
Our understanding, Mr. Chairman, is that counsel for the requester would be happy to give us an extension so that we may consider this further.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Vice Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to disclose, consistent with our ex parte contact rules, that I had asked essentially the same question directly of counsel and had a short discussion about the possibilities of them being able to operate this APAC through their insurance subsidiary.
Okay. Thank you. So anyway, my proposal is that we hold this matter over to our meeting of October 11th. Any further discussion on this matter? Okay. Hearing none, we will deem this matter held over to our next meeting. Counsel, thank you very much. I appreciate your efforts.